this afternoon, as a matter of fact, while I'm thinking of it.
Yeah, I think if we can come up with any kind of good musical and documentary material, then I'll probably sic myself on Bernice, whom I first met in the living room of Joe and Jackie back in that very day.
1962 or 3, yeah.
When she was still part of the Freedom Singers and with Cordell Reagan.
Her beloved first husband.
Yes.
I'm not sure so much about the beloved part, but first husband is accurate.
Times have changed.
Indeed.
Gentlemen, is this the level at which you'll be
talking? I think so.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
I think this is a pretty good conversational level. I don't expect my end to change very much.
All right. I'm going to give you my phone number, and you can call me when you're done, unless you'd like me to sit with you. I don't imagine you would.
I believe we are good to go.
I am at 202-513-2590.
Great.
And my name is Mark. All right, Dave. Okay. All right, Kip.
Okay, thank you.
We are rolling?
You are indeed.
Okay. Kip, let's start by talking about the world that black gospel music came out of. Basically a 19th century world, even though it extended into the 1920s, 20s, and 30s, but a mostly southern, partly rural, partly urban world. But just tell me a little bit about the culture and the role of both church and church music.
That's a big question, Dave. The world that gospel music came out of really is largely southern. When the Great Migration began to occur in the teens and 20s, of course, a lot of black and white citizens of the U.S. moved from rural areas of the South up to urban northern areas, and that's why, in some regards, you look at Chicago in the 1930s with Reverend Thomas Dorsey as, in some ways, the birthplace for modern gospel music because of his compositions and his work with choirs there starting in the very late 1920s and early 1930s. Yet a lot of the people who were involved in that first wave of gospel, and of course gospel is a very tricky word to define. It depends on if you're talking of very precisely about when composed gospel songs began, or if you're looking at gospel as a term that's more encompassing to describe a whole range of types of religious music.
Yeah, I would say that we're probably functionally Jubilee through modern gospel, but
okay.
let me refocus because in a way I want to start talking about the world before Chicago and the world before recording.
Gotcha. Okay.
Again, in this mostly southern, mostly if not completely rural world, how important was the church as an institution, and how important as a function of that institution was church music?
For black Americans living in the South, whether it's before or after Reconstruction, in many ways the church was the focal point for community life. And it was a focal point not just on Sunday morning when people would come from different plantations or different homes to meet at church, but it also served as a social nexus for people. If you had a problem, it was not just perhaps solved religiously, but somebody in the church may come and help you. Since black Americans were legally disenfranchised, really, before and after, although albeit for a little while right after Reconstruction, you had blacks in legislatures, but for all intents and purposes, blacks remained segregated. They lived in an entirely different world. They lived by different rules than white people because they didn't have the same kind of access to education. In many places, they really couldn't, for various reasons, own land. So even though it might be after 1865, for all intents and purposes, many black Americans lived the same kind of life that they did prior to the end of the war between the states, which means that the church served as a way that people might gather to not only have some sense of religion and religious orientation, but the pastor could, for example, serve as a spokesperson for the community. If you needed help with a project, you might ask some of the other people, not just necessarily in your community, but people in the church, to help come together to build a cabin, to help out if there's some problem with a family. If you were in need of food, the church was really the central organizing social entity for Black Americans well into the 20th century.
It was also an area, a culture of high illiteracy at that time, and a very orally oriented culture. How did this manifest itself in the style and the significance of the preacher?
In Black churches, most of the people who attended church who were African American at that time were illiterate. I mean, there were illiteracy. The rate of literacy in the United States, of course, has increased over the years. It would have been higher for white Americans than Black Americans, but for the most part, Black Americans were not able to read and write. It wasn't until after the war between the states that Fisk and Hampton and other institutions of higher education came in, and really it wasn't until well into the 20th century you had a higher and increasing rate of literacy. So for Black Americans in the church, the preacher was the person who was the intermediary between you and God. The kind of life lessons that the church had to give were transmitted through the preacher. And this is really, there's an interesting nexus, I think, also between the importance of the preacher and the importance of singing in churches. This was, as you suggested, largely an oral tradition, so that songs that were handed down from times of slavery. I remember interviewing a Black gospel quartet singer in Memphis in 1980, and he was talking about Rolling Through an Unfriendly Land, which I knew was a pre-Civil War spiritual. He said, you know, that's a really old song that that I learned in Mississippi in the late 1920s and early 30s. And I said, well, you know, the first written version of this I've seen is from 1863. And he was really surprised that generation after generation after generation had picked up songs like that, and they'd been transmitted orally. And of course, in the 1870s and 1880s, that was a time period in which both solo artists but also groups of singers were singing songs that were largely in oral tradition. And that also means there's a lot of regionality happening. The performance styles that you might find in the southeastern United States, and whether it's solo singing or choruses or choirs or quartets, would be different from Mississippi to Georgia to Virginia. So there are all kinds of, because of the diversity of the oral tradition and also the geographical diversity, and also I think to some degree, especially earlier on where people came from West Africa or through the Caribbean, all of those contributed to kind of the diversity of singing, but nonetheless, much of it was orally based.
The style of the preacher. He was not so much expected to be a scholar or maybe even a community leader as a kind of performer.
Black preaching, especially in Protestant churches and to some degree to Pentecostal churches, it's a performance. It's also largely an oral performance. It's meant to be inspirational. And as you suggested, not so much looking at what somebody might get through a formal training at a seminary, but I think a lot of people are called, they're called by God to do things. And if you're called to preach, that's a hard thing. That's a hard, if you're called to preach, that's difficult to ignore. If you are called to do something like that, you're compelled to do it, you will preach whether you are formally educated or not. And there's a particular kind of cadence that you hear in Baptist churches, the kind of chanted sermon that is really kind of mediating between singing and the spoken word. There isn't anything quite like it, but if you listen to civil rights leaders, recordings of Martin Luther King in the 1960s and 1950s, if you listen to a whole host of Black leaders, you can listen to Obama when he starts to speak Black, so to speak. You can hear those kinds of cadences, and a lot of that, you can go right back and listen to the chanted sermons of Black preachers, and that goes well in, back into the 19th century.
And in most Black churches, After the preacher, perhaps the second most important institution within the church was the choir.
In a lot of ways, the choir was secondary in importance to the preacher. But, you know, it wasn't just choirs. It was music making of all kinds. Because in certain churches, they might have a very small group, maybe a quartet, maybe a trio. It wasn't really until into the 20th century that choirs, per se, became important. But there was always music making of some kind. Wouldn't matter if you were in Southwest Louisiana, it could be an accordion player playing and singing. If you were in Alabama, where quartets were really important starting at the turn of the century, it could be a quartet performing at the church. If you were someplace else, it might be a guitar player or a piano player singing. And a lot of times, of course, this material is so familiar to everybody that you might have a leader, but that line between the congregation and the person who was the singer or the people who were part of the ensemble was really blurred, because often everybody would join in. It became very much of a community event within the church itself.
Now, again, within this small universe of, let's say, 1865 to 1925, for blind black children, what were the expectations? What were the training opportunities?
Boy, if you were blind and African American in the late 19th and early 20th century, your opportunities were quite limited. I mean, it was be difficult enough to gain any kind of formal education, even through elementary school, if you were black. But if you were blind and black, I mean, every state had a colored school for the blind. Poorly funded, and if you lived in Texas, I'm assuming there was one school for the blind there, but, you know, if you lived over in El Paso and that school for the blind was in Dallas, the chances of you making it all the way across West Texas were quite limited. So the expectations, I think, were largely driven by families, because I don't think society really cared that much. And so it would be the exceptional person who would have, first of all, had the opportunity to go to school. The family said, it's important enough for us to send our child to the school that may be 50 miles away, 200 miles away, so that it was the minority of black Americans who were blind who got that opportunity. But I think it was, they tended to be in some ways the exceptional people, because they had the wherewithal of the family and the community behind them supporting them.
There does seem to be a fairly consistent pattern in the so-called blind schools for African Americans in the South to have music education as part of it. What's the association? What's the logic? Why logically should there be this association between education for the blind and musical training?
I think that there are several reasons why, but I think probably the most important reason why it was something that folks could do without having to have sight. You could teach somebody to sing, since this was still largely an oral tradition. You didn't have to be able to read Braille. If you had any inclination to be a singer already, having that kind of institutionalized, whether it's the five blind boys from Mississippi meeting at school there, or if you were even sighted and you were at Hampton. I mean, it was important to represent for black culture. It was important to represent for the school. And what better way to represent for the school than to be a singer going out in the community at large and saying, I'm singing for the Alabama School for the Blind, or I'm singing for the Virginia School for the Blind. And that was a good way to become an ambassador.
In this pre-recording era, the music professionals tended to be local, as you say, and begat really distinctive local styles. Overwhelmingly, they're men, and it would seem, even among men, you had to be a tough guy to be a street singer.
I'll tell you, it would be difficult enough to be black and to be blind, but then to try to make a living as a street performer, playing in the streets of Atlanta or Wichita Falls or Lynchburg or wherever it might be in the South at the turn of the century, I can't imagine how difficult that would be, because no social services. You were really at the mercy of the elements and the mercy of the people who would help to support you. And it would seem to me that the ones that we know about, you know, into the 1920s and 1930s, again, were the people who were, seemed to be exceptionally talented. But I agree with you, that would have been a very hard way to go. But then you have to think, what options were there? You could train to be a cobbler. You could train to repair furniture. You couldn't really go into education, because most colleges, and at that time, of course, you were going to an historically black college or university, if we're talking the early part of the 20th century, were not equipped to deal with blind students, even if you were able to get an elementary and high school education. So there really weren't, for all intents and purposes, educational opportunities. So if you had the chutzpah, you had the ability, and you didn't want to be tied down, being an itinerant street singer, perhaps tied to a traveling show of some kind. Now, we know that Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey were itinerant singers working with tent shows. There were some blind singers working with traveling shows like that, but I think the majority of them stayed more locally where they had a support network, at least they knew they could count on.
Probably the most famous blind singer lead boy team was that of Blind Lemon Jefferson, not a gospel performer, but and Leadbelly. What are some of the scrapes? What are some of the perils that the two of them dealt with on the streets of Dallas or Shreveport? Or,
well, when Leadbelly and Blind Lemon Jefferson were working together in East Texas in around 1912 or 1913, Leadbelly was probably about 10 years younger than Blind Lemon, although we're not sure about the exact age difference. They had to worry about being robbed. They had to worry about being cheated. They had to worry about how they were going to get around. They also operated in a largely black arena because, I mean, I've been in and out of East Texas enough to know that that area that they were working was virtually entirely agrarian, largely cotton picking area at that time. And it was also difficult because it was seasonal. When the crops were being picked in the fall and late summer, there was some money around. When there wasn't money around, then you had to go to the juke joints. Then you had to go to the play in the street corners. Juke joints especially could get a little bit rough. And in that part of the country, they were called suki jumps. They're the kind of places where gambling was going on, drinking was going on. And a Friday or Saturday night, a suki jump in East Texas where they were working could get a little bit dangerous.
It was a violent world.
It could be a very violent world. And, Leadbelly ended up in prison several times accused of either manslaughter or murder, though I'm not entirely convinced that he was guilty of either of those. But that underscores the violent world in which they lived. And so there was always, you always had to keep a pistol at your side, because you know what? The law didn't really care if two black Americans kill one another. It's just some more black guys gone.
The archetypal blind gospel street singer, Blind Willie Johnson, his voice says tough.
Oh, tough and very, very expressive, because he has a falsetto and a very gruff voice. And I would have loved to have been around Marlin, Texas, when he was playing there in the teens and 20s. That would have been something to really hear.
His message and his repertoire may have given him some cover as a religious person, but basically he was working a lot of the same rough street corners that Blind Lemon and Leadbelly were. Again, a violent world for a blind person to deal with.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think one of the things that might have set Blind Willie Johnson apart was that he was explicitly a gospel singer. He was more associated with the church as opposed to somebody like Blind Lemon, who would have, along with Leadbelly, done religious material as part of their singing around. But to the best of my knowledge, Blind Willie Johnson strictly sang religious music for much of his mid to later life. And that gave him kind of a cachet, too. You don't want to mess with him because he's a man of God. I think that would have set him apart. And I can't imagine he was also playing the Saturday night juke joints would have kept him out of trouble, too. So I think that elevated him to a certain status that some of the other folks might not have had.
Once he became a recording artist, how did that change his life or change... he was actually quite a significant recording artist.
Yeah, he made great records for Columbia back in the late 1920s. I think that financially, the recordings would have meant very little because he would have been paid something like $50 a side, not gotten any royalties. The significance, I think, of the recordings are twofold for us. One is we actually have documentary evidence of what he sounded like instead of just anecdotal. Well, you should have heard Blind Willie Johnson. He was one of the greatest, singers I ever heard. We actually know what he sounded like, which is one significant thing. The other is that I think as he traveled around, he may not have made money directly from his recordings for Columbia, but the fact that he was a recording artist itself, man, that was a big deal back in the late 1920s. If you were black and you'd made records for a major record company. So I think that was kind of a selling point that he had that gave him an advantage over other people in terms of setting up, I would assume, performances as he traveled around. Columbia recording artist Blind Willie Johnson. I've never seen any flyers for anything that he may have done, but the word got around. Here's one of our brothers who made records. He's going to be in the area. Let's go to hear him sing.
It's probably good information about how dangerous a world street singing was, is that there were relatively few, very, very few, street singing women.
Oh, I'll tell you, as I sit here and kind of file through my brain for that time period for street singers, you get pretty hard-pressed to think of women who are doing that. It's being on the streets is hard enough for a woman, but being a blind black female trying to make their way through the world in this context in 1915 or 1920 is almost unfathomable here in the 21st century.
So one of the things that the invention of recordings, that the recording era does, is that it creates opportunities for women. Arizona Drains is a recording artist.
Indeed, and she was involved with Pentecostal churches in the mid to late 1920s, ended up recording for OK as a solo artist, largely because she had been involved with the recordings. I think it was Reverend McGee, if I'm not mistaken, who first got her into the studio, and they heard the genius that was that kind of barrel house sanctified piano style. And again, fortunately, we have enough recordings. But, it's being a piano player gives you yet a different kind of aspect, because unlike the guitar or unlike an accordion, which other blind black musicians might play, the piano wasn't portable. You couldn't go out there and play in a street corner playing piano, so that gave you yet another issue to deal with as you were kind of itinerant singer. And you think about black, female, blind, itinerant gospel singers who played guitar, and that number is small. I think his sister O.M. Terrell, who was not blind but a street singer and a black guitarist, I'm trying to think of anybody who fits that mold, and I'm really coming up empty. Doesn't mean there weren't any, because that's one other thing to always consider when you're talking about the recording industry, is how many people are out there that we missed. And you can be sure it was the majority of people who didn't make records that you keep hearing about. You talk to Gary Davis and talk about the people that he knew. Talk to all kinds of other black artists who are active in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. None of them are alive now, but if you were doing this early enough, you hear stories, you should have heard, Blind Willie Walker. Well, fortunately, he made a record for Columbia, but he was one of those people that Gary Davis always spoke about. How many people were like Willie Walker who made no records that were, street singers? My guess is there were dozens of them that we don't really know about, but it's hard to document that.
When the five blind boys of Alabama decided one, to become a professional group, and two, to take their act on the road. The idea of gospel groups was well established, the format was well established, but the idea of an all-blind or blind, with the exception of one-sighted performer group, has to have been something of a breakthrough, something new.
Yeah, the Five Blind Boys came along at a time when the whole idea of not just being a quartet, but being a quartet that was professional was being launched. You had the you had groups like the Golden Gate Quartet starting in the mid-1930s as the group that was traveling around, performing on CBS, and becoming a fully professional group. The famous Blue Jay Singers out of Birmingham, Alabama, started to hit the road around the same time, mid to late 1930s. And I think it was an inspiration to groups like the Five Blind Boys, who thought, you know, we're good. We can sing just like these guys. This is something new, because this is really a level of professionalism that had developed during the Depression, which, again, is another difficult time to start doing anything. But the first fully professional gospel quartets were really going around 1936, 1937, in that time frame. Perfect in terms of being role models for the Five Blind Boys, who thought, we can not only represent for our institution, we can also represent for gospel music. And I think a lot of them felt compelled. A lot of them felt very strongly that this is part of their calling, in the same way that people are called to preach. We are called to sing. And the Five Blind Boys were really at kind of the beginning of the professional level of African-American gospel quartet singing, and indeed African-American professional gospel singing in general.
Among the gospel quartets, the Five Blind Boys of Alabama are quite distinctive in their style, in a musical form in which so-called trickeration, syncopation, counterpoint, all sorts of tonal nuances and subtle shifts of rhythm and tone. And the Five Blind Boys of Alabama have nothing to do with any of that. They sing hard, and then they sing harder, and then they sing harder than that. In a way, for me, the word for their singing is cathartic.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you're to listen to, there was a whole group of people who followed in the footsteps of the Golden Gate Quartet, with Willie Johnson's major innovations being that kind of pumping bass that you heard throughout so many recordings, his very masterful lead that involved really a lot of vocal manipulations. But that hard gospel style you're talking about with the Five Blind Boys, which was much more common in Mississippi, Alabama, into parts of Louisiana, where the harmony was there, but it was not as emphasized. It was the raw, emotional singing that really got people. And that's really, when people think of gospel music, they think largely of that kind of shouting style, because that's what they're used to. Of course, it's much more nuanced than that. But in terms of hard gospel quartets, the Five Blind Boys of Alabama shouted down the church about as well as any group could.
Of course, one of the things that transformed their career was their participation in Gospel at Colonus. And the whole concept of Gospel at Colonus is that there is a unity of in all oral cultures, from Greek tragic through West Africa, through African-American church culture, of both of a kind of charismatic singing tradition meant to evoke an emotional breakthrough that Aristotle called catharsis. There is a kind of uncanny fit here, I think, of the Five Blind Boys and Sophocles.
Yeah, I think that the blind singers that I have known and talked with and interviewed and heard perform, I think there's some intangible kind of special gift that a lot of them have, an ability to not just do the obvious thing, which is to transcend their handicap because they can't see, but there seems just to be they are touched to present this message in a way that other people can't. I think it's a very difficult thing to verbalize, but in just thinking back to the people I've known who fit into that, including a man named Daniel Womack, who I think should be more widely recognized, blind singer out of Roanoke, Virginia, who I knew very well. He really fit into the same kind of mold as a versatile guy. He was a storyteller. He was the person, when I was around Roanoke, who first started to tell us about black dulcimer players and makers. Because when he grew up around Danville, Virginia, in the teens and 20s, there were black dulcimer players. And, you know, we never thought about that before. But he just opened up the world in ways to us that we had never thought about, including, that he also illustrated that tension between the secular and the sacred world, because at certain points he'd been a blues player too. And by the time that we started to visit him in the early to mid-1970s, there was that tension between the sacred world and the secular world that Gary Davis and Blind Willie McTell and others had to mediate between. And I think they did it quite successfully, as did Daniel. But Daniel, by that point in his life, who he's probably in his early 70s then, had said, I'm really a church man. I've kind of left that blues stuff to the side or behind me, because my real calling is to spread the word of God.
Getting back to the cathartic idea, one of the things held in common by these oral societies is an association of blindness with a compensatory second sight, that blind people have a kind of extra perception that allows them to commune with the gods or to understand life. Lee Brewer asserts that the same extra valence, if you will, that a blind performer would have had for Sophocles' audience, blind performers in black church in Mississippi or Alabama in 1925 would have been accorded the same extra level of charisma, if you will, of power, of magic, mojo.
Yeah, I mean, in thinking of the of blind, of groups composed of blind singers and of blind performers of different kinds, there's a certain those singers, it seemed to me, not only are men and women or groups of God, they, I think, are viewed as being somehow anointed, somehow given a special gift. Maybe it's partly they have another obstacle that a lot of us don't have to overcome, and perhaps given the fact that they have overcome this by becoming well-recognized and accomplished performers, people say, well, this group can do this, and on top of that, they're also blind. They've been able to transcend these kinds of disabilities, these limitations, and they've done it so well. There must be something special about them.
When you see a high wire act, the first thing that's in the front of your mind is how vulnerable the performers are.
Are they going to fall off or not? My God, how can they do that?
And blind performers also are perpetually surviving their own vulnerability right before your eyes. This does have an enlargening. This does have an empowering effect, don't you think?
Yeah, it gives them It sets them apart from people who clearly are gifted and talented. But when you look at someone who has the limitation of not being sighted, and they can do this well, and also teach other people. Now, Gary Davis taught loads and loads of people over the years. as did people, I think, in the community. They would come to singers like Gary Davis or Daniel Womack to think of people who were active in the 60s and 70s as in some ways part of the folk revival. And I think people viewed that gift not only as one that they were able to transmit to a larger audience, but people came to them for lessons, and I think they thought that part of the gift was they could also share that music through lessons in a way perhaps that sighted musicians couldn't, because they had to really convey it in a different kind of way.
We've come a long way from the educational opportunities of the Alabama State School for the Colored Blind of 1933, when the blind boys entered. But still, Valerie Capers is, I think, the only blind graduate in the history of Juilliard.
So many schools are not set up to deal with people with all kinds of disabilities. In thinking about schools like Curtis in Philadelphia, I taught one year up at Peabody at Johns Hopkins. Since so much of the tradition that they deal with requires you to be able to read music, and conservatories are set up in such a way that if you are blind, it presents yet another barrier because of the kinds of training that you get at a school like a conservatory. The barriers are almost insurmountable just because the traditions at conservatories, i.e. usually largely Western European classical traditions, are so based not in oral traditions like they are for many other people around the world, but in being able to read sheet music. It's in some ways remarkable that there's a single blind graduate of Juilliard.
What Valerie sort of says is they weren't comfortable with blind people, and they somehow decided that was okay. It's not going to work. We're not comfortable, so it's not going to work for them.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of people I know who are blind who wanted to go to conservatories, and I think people stay, talented musicians tend to stay away from conventional conservatories because I think in some ways some of the music that they want to play, perhaps improvised music like jazz, for example, is not the kind of things conservatories have in the past dealt with, although I think that's certainly changing. New England Conservatory would be a good example of a more broad-based approach, and increasingly Juilliard and other places are too. But I think in the past, if you've been blind and you want to be a musician, probably the place you don't want to be is a conservatory, because number one, they may not be doing the kind of music that you want to play. Number two, they're just not set up for people like that at all.
I think we're done.
Okay.
Anything you can think of that I should have asked you in all the context of this stuff that I haven't? We've got some great Gary Davis stuff from Dave Bromberg.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
Was his lead boy for a while.
Yeah, working with Gary very closely.
Hello.
Hello.
Are you with Elizabeth Sjogren, or were you?
No.
No, she must be next door.
Okay.
I was able to talk a little bit about Daniel Womack because he's one of the people I think
should have... Yes, and we've got some Womack material.
Okay, you got it through, yeah. And that would have been stuff through the Blue Ridge Institute, I'm sure.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think if there are any other blind musicians that I've run into that are worth mentioning. Because I know I spent once, when Daniel came up to play the National Folk Festival, I accompanied him up here for the week he was there and did lots of different school events with him over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of other people that you may not have covered, you've got Gary Davis covered.
Yeah, and we've got some good Arizona Drains material.
Where did that material come from?
Well, secondhand, but Jerma Jackson told some nice anecdotes.
Yep. Yeah, because I know Malcolm Shaw did most of the original material, original research on Arizona Drains. some of the other blind singing groups like Blind Boys of Mississippi? Covering, trying to deal with them at all? They would be cut out of the same, similar mode to the Five Points.
Let me ask you what, you know, for a while they became a team, and they would stage battles. The Blind Boys of Alabama, the Blind
Song
Boys
battles,
of Mississippi.
Sure.
So clearly, their blindness per se, some promoter thought, was in itself an attraction. What perception of the audience do you think is drove the? As I say, this became a series that played probably coast to coast eventually of the battle of the 2-5 blind boys.
I think that particular idea of contestation between blind gospel quartets really fits into a larger aesthetic in Black American culture. If you think about piano cutting contests in Harlem that Fats Waller might have done with James P. Johnson in 1924-25, if you look to more recent examples, might be in hip-hop culture, dancing, movement, battles between different dance crews. The NBA dunking contest is, I think, another example of that. What I believe would have been in the mind of a promoter was, hey, we not only have gospel quartet song contests, because I interviewed people who were judges in all kinds of quartet contests kind of like this in Memphis in the 1930s and 40s. This just added a different flavor to it. Not only do we have a quartet contest going on, because those were not at all unusual, here we have two prominent groups that are well known who also happen to be blind. So this was just yet another tool for promotion in the 1940s and into the 1950s for having these kind of contests. And I'm sure that the promoter thought this would be a way to gain a slightly wider audience, because you not only have the quartet contest, you have the blind quartets battling one another.
Okay, anything else we've unturned?
No, can't really think of anything.
All right, let me call Mark.
Have you been doing most of the interviews for this?
Yeah.
Did you catch German down in Chapel Hill?
On the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't know if you could have gotten a, you know, studio link up for down there.
It was at the local
UNC.
NPN. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I think for some reason the Chapel Hill studio was booked, then she had to go to Raleigh.
Ah, okay.
Hey, Mark, it's David. We are done.
All right, my good man. I'm just hovering right there.
Thanks.
And how did you get hooked up with this project?
Well, Steve Rath and I go back donkey's years.
Yes, decades.
And quartet in particular has always been one of my mania.